From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-il, died this month at the age of 69. Back in 2009, North Korea had walked away from six-nation nuclear talks, vowing never to return to the table. And in this summer of saber-rattling, we were joined on the program by the scholar and commentator B.R. Myers. Myers said that most of the West believes North Korea's ideology is this mixture of Confucianism and Stalinism. Both prize self-discipline. He says that couldn't be further from the truth. Here's how Myers describes the North Korean political culture. Race-based paranoid nationalism with a profound connection to a parental leader and more a mother than a father. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with B.R. Myers on the North Korean regime, its history, and its political culture. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. This month, North Korean leader Kim Jong-il died at the age of 69. 2 years ago, Kim's third son, Kim Jong-un, was named the great successor. Very little is known about the younger Kim, though he's thought to be in his late 20s, may have attended school in Switzerland. The BBC has reported that North Korea's two attacks on South Korea last year are widely regarded as actions led by Kim Jong-un. Back in the summer of 2009, when tensions were running particularly high on the peninsula, we were joined by the scholar and commentator B.R. Myers. He helped us explore North Korea's behavior and its history, as well as its political culture. Myers' book on North Korean ideology and propaganda is just out in paperback. It's called The Cleanest Race. What Americans seem to know about North Korea are the stories of repression and the eccentricities of their former leader. But B.R. Myers says what we don't really understand is the political culture of North Korea.
It's strange to me that during the Cold War, we took a lot of effort to learn more about communism. And since 9/11, I think we've all learned a lot more about extreme Islamism than we used to. And yet, although we've had basically 60-some years of confrontation with North Korea, we've never taken any time to try to figure out the country's ideology, the country's worldview. In other words, we don't know how the country looks at itself and the world around it. And I think this is one reason why the country seems so bizarre to us.
So what do you make, then, of this preoccupation we seem to have with the strangeness of Kim Jong-il's, obsessions and inclinations? You say that we should focus less on that and more on the ideology.
Yeah, because if we do focus on the ideology, we begin to understand that the country's behavior is not that bizarre and unpredictable enough after all. And even Kim Jong-il's public image, which strikes many of us Americans as ludicrous, begins to make a lot more sense when you look at it in the context of the ideology and the propaganda that has been dinned into the heads of North Koreans for the past 60-some years.
I want to begin to sort of see if we can draw a bead then on North Korean ideology, how we explain or describe it. You've said that Kim Jong-il is not a Stalinist and that his party ideology...
He's not a Stalinist.
Yeah, and it has nothing to do with Soviet-style communism. So how do you describe it? What is his ideology?
It's actually a very easy ideology to grasp. But in order to understand it, perhaps you have to go back to 1945 when the North Korean state was set up by the Soviet occupying forces. What happened was that there was almost a complete lack of communists on Korean soil at that time. The communist movement in Korea had never really gotten off the ground, and most of the communists were still in Seoul at the time that North Korea started rolling in Pyongyang. So what happened was that the official culture was set up in Pyongyang by former pro-Japanese collaborators who knew very little about communism. And Kim Il-sung himself was really just a guerrilla. He was a fighting man who had very little grasp of Marxism-Leninism himself. So what happened was basically that the intelligentsia simply Koreanized the Japanese worldview that they had grown up with in the Japanese colonial period. So they simply took Kim Il-sung and set him up as a Korean version of what Emperor Hirohito had been. In other words, where Hirohito had been the symbol of Japanese racial purity, Kim Il-sung was set up as the symbol of Korean racial purity. And, of course, the whole notion of a pure race is anathema to Marxism. It's actually completely irreconcilable with Marxism-Leninism. Hmm. So what happened during the Cold War was that the North Korean regime would pay lip service to Marxism in its international speeches or in its high-profile speeches, while the domestic masses themselves were indoctrinated in a very extreme, paranoid, race-based nationalism.
So this this kind of crude sense of racism emerges, in the 1950s in the propaganda. And you write about the fact that Caucasian features, for example, were expressed in propaganda as the very manifestation of the evil and the villainy.
Of the Americans, exactly.
Right.
Of course, nationalism always comes a bit to the fore in any kind of war, and so does xenophobia. But it's interesting to compare Soviet propaganda during the Second World War with North Korean propaganda during the Korean War. The Soviets were always at pains to draw a distinction between, say, common American soldiers and American officers, or between the capitalist class on the one hand and the working class on the other. Whereas in North Korea, we Americans are villainized, or we are demonized as a race. Mm-hmm. Americans are considered to be inherently evil. So as you said, Korean propaganda very much is made of Americans' big noses and sunken eyes and pale skins and all the things that distinguish Caucasians from Asians. And this is what caused North Korea so many problems inside the East Bloc. The Soviets and the East Germans and all those people were horrified by what they correctly saw as the racist strains in North Korean propaganda. So even during the Cold War, North Korea was isolated from its allies in the East Bloc.
There's a story you write about this visit by the Cuban ambassador, and I think it was 1965.
Right.
And he was attacked based solely on the way he looked, on his race.
Exactly. Yeah, he was squiring some Cuban doctors around town who were in Pyongyang to perform charity work, and his official limousine was surrounded by a mob of North Koreans who were shouting racial epithets because the Cuban ambassador at that time was a black man. Mm. And the North Korean police had to come and fight the people off. And when the Cuban ambassador complained to the regime, he was told very unselfconsciously by the cadre he was talking to that the North Korean people are incapable of distinguishing between friends and foes. And I think that's still the case. People need to understand that North Korea's problem is not simply with the United States. The North Koreans believe that they are the purest and most inherently moral and virtuous race in the world, and therefore all outsiders are morally inferior and not to be trusted. And I think you can see this attitude reflected in North Korea's refusal to abide by any treaties. North Korea had just as dysfunctional a relationship with its allies in the old East Bloc as it now has with the United States.
There was a documentary produced by a British documentary firm. They were granted access into North Korea. And there was this moment in the documentary when they're documenting this family having a meal, and the power goes out, as it apparently often does at times. The power grid is notoriously unreliable. And when it finally goes back on, the mother in the family says, "Damn Americans," which led you to believe that when things go bad, they often blame the Americans. Is that true? I mean,
that is the strategy, and this strategy really emerged in the mid 1990s when the North Korean regime saw the famine coming. And they knew that they had to dissociate themselves from the famine. They had to recuse themselves of all responsibility for the famine. And they basically did this by saying that the regime would have to spend all of its time protecting the country from the imminent American threat, and that therefore Kim Jong-il would not be able to spend as much time worrying about feeding the people and clothing the people as his father Kim Il-sung had done. So this is why the North Korean people do not generally hold their own regime responsible for their economic hardship. They blame the United States instead, which is distracting or which is preventing the leader from doing his usual job of feeding and clothing the people.
So when you're talking about the way that the North Koreans perceive their own natural virtue, the idea is that the North Korean is naturally good.
Right.
And then you write about this a word that's hard to translate. Sobakham, I think, is how you how
right.
it's written. A term that you say corresponds with this idea of spontaneity, which is
right.
Which is seen in other regimes, in other Stalinist socialist regimes, as a bad thing. In North Korea, this idea of spontaneity is considered a strength. It's a good thing. I wanted you to talk about that because that's really interesting.
Yeah, it's very logical, really, because if you believe that your race is inherently virtuous, if you believe that you are essentially born good, then it follows from that that your instincts are also good and that you should heed your pure instincts instead of trying to temper them through book learning and the like. So the North Koreans are often encouraged by their own propaganda to be as children. And this is one reason why the leader in North Korea is not depicted so much as the patriarchal father figure as more of a motherly parent leader who protects this childlike race so that it can indulge its instincts with impunity. And that is something very different from Stalinism, because the whole point of Stalinism, or to use the other word for it, Marxism-Leninism, was that the Communist Party had to instill revolutionary consciousness into the masses so that they would fulfill a revolution. So spontaneity was always seen under Stalinism as something enemy. And in North Korea, it's the friend of the people, really. And this is why that documentary that you referred to, made by those British filmmakers, I think it was mistitled when they referred to it as, when they called the movie A State of Mind.
Yeah.
And that's in keeping with that documentary's general misperception of North Korea as a Stalinist state. And I find it very fitting that when the North Koreans translated that title into Korean, they instead called it the country of feelings. This is indeed a country where the instincts are put above the heart. Where the heart is put above the head, and not the other way around.
And you say this induces a lot of. There's a lot of violence in North Korean daily life that it's tolerated. It's seen as, natural.
Yeah, it's seen. The North Koreans generally believe that their people are not capable of premeditated evil. At worst, the Koreans being inherently virtuous, being inherently good, they will occasionally let their emotions get the better of them, and they will perhaps, under duress, engage in regrettable acts. But the police do not seem to crack down on fisticuffs and that sort of thing to the extent that we saw in the old East Bloc. I used to travel in East Germany, and I never remember seeing any kind of violence there. It is a much different sort of society in North Korea. And this has implications, I think, for the military as well, because the North Korean military has a history of acting quite rashly. Things like the shoot down of the EC-121 spy plane in 1969 or the Panmunjom axe murders in 1976, these were clearly cases of soldiers quite low down on the command structure losing control of themselves and acting very rashly, which again is a sort of behavior that we did not see during the Cold War from our communist adversaries.
Mm. So then the role of Kim Jong-il, as you've said, is as a maternal figure to nurture and protect the people, indulge them in their natural instincts, I guess. And you even talk about the way Kim Jong-il is shown soft-cheeked, very motherly, described as more of a mother than all of the mothers in the world. And you say that the West kind of makes fun of his appearance, whereas the North Koreans see that kind of dowdy appearance as, comforting, I guess.
Yeah, they do. I mean, I think that in the mid-1990s, even before Kim Il-sung died, the economy was already in a free fall. And the North Korean propaganda apparatus was well aware that it could not present Kim Jong-il as the kind of all-round Superman that his father had been. In other words, they knew that it would not be possible to present Kim Jong-il as a man who feeds and houses his people and does everything perfectly. So instead, they decided to make a virtue out of his vulnerability, to make a virtue out of his human limitations. So the propaganda apparatus often depicts Kim Jong-il as fretting or worrying about not being quite as great a leader as his father was. But I think this is one of the reasons for his appeal. A good deal of his appeal seems to be that he is a guilt figure. He induces guilt among the people. If you watch North Korean TV programs or movies, often the characters will burst out in tears because they feel that they are not feeding their leader well enough. So where it was Kim Il-sung's duty to feed the people, now it is the people's duty to feed Kim Jong-il.
B.R. Myers, he's a contributing editor to The Atlantic and a researcher of North Korean ideology and propaganda. We spoke with him back in 2009. We should mention his book, The Cleanest Race, is just now out in paperback. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Earlier this month, North Korean leader Kim Jong-il died of a heart attack at the age of 69. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our 2009 conversation about the behavior of North Korea. Our guest was the scholar B.R. Myers, who says this is about political culture. He joined us by phone from his home in South Korea. B.R. Myers, how do you describe daily life for North Koreans? I wanted to talk a little bit about this. It seems that this idea of subsistence, of just getting by, even starvation at times and famine, that seems to be a part of the allure, which is strange to imagine, in terms of their connection to the leader.
Yeah, I think that the hardship that almost everybody shares in North Korea is one of the things that binds them to the leader. He is also a symbol of the hardship that people are suffering. Of course, we know, or we think we know, more about his private life, and I think it's safe to assume that he does live very well indeed. But his image in the media in North Korea is of a man who is so busy traveling the country, checking military bases, making sure that the soldiers are eating enough and making sure that the soldiers are being treated well, that he has no time to take care of himself or to feed himself properly. And indeed, the propaganda apparatus has so far not even conceded that Kim Jong-il has a family at all, that he even has a wife and kids. And I think in that sense, he does inspire people to work harder and not to complain about their own lot. And it does indeed seem to be a life of very extreme hardship. I was in the town of Kaesong, and just looking out the window and walking the streets and looking at the people, it is a standard of living that is much lower than the standard of living that I saw in East Germany in 1983. Starvation itself is not quite so common anymore, but according to most of the estimates of NGOs that have worked in North Korea, about a third of the population is malnourished. And you can tell when you see them that they really are stunted. They are a good, I would say, 5 or 6 inches shorter on average than people in South Korea, which is actually quite a turnaround because, historically speaking, the Koreans in the northern part of the peninsula used to be taller than those in the south. As for their life, they are organized. The Workers' Party tries to keep them in group activities from morning to night, I think for the usual reasons, in order to discourage people from thinking critically about the situation that they're in. But generally speaking, it's not a sort of 24/7, perfectly functioning 1984 kind of state. I think it's a much more ramshackle sort of place than we imagine it to be usually.
So is it true that Kim Jong-il is actually, or at least he says, he's proud of the economic disparity between the North in the South, that South Koreans may be living more comfortably, but they're puppets of the American imperialists. We're making these great sacrifices, and we're an independent people.
Right. I wouldn't say so much that they're proud of the hardship itself, but they are proud of the sacrifice that they are making to ensure that North Korea remains free and remains safe from American imperialism. So this is indeed how the propaganda apparatus tries to dismiss the fact of South Korea's economic superiority. They say the South Koreans may be richer than we are. They may live in nicer houses and wear nicer clothes, but they live in the shame and the guilt of having their country run by the Americans.
Let's go to the phones. Devin is with us in Salt Lake City. Devin, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, everything I've been hearing lately, it just reminds me of cults like Jim Jones or the Branch Davidians. If they had their own nation state, it seems like North Korea would be it. I just think in our foreign policy that if we approached them the way we would approach a cult and tried to deal with them the way, you know, we deal with cults, in other words, always instead of drawing them together with threats or force, using, you know, criticism of their leaders, would be a more effective use of our time. And I was just hoping your guest could comment on Korea as a cult rather than a nation state.
B.R. Myers, what do you think?
Well, the one misconception that I would like to correct is the misconception that the North Koreans regard their leader as a god or as a divine figure. The personality cult has never attributed supernatural powers to the leader. He's regarded as being, of course, the greatest Korean alive, but by no means as being a supernatural person. Of course, having said that, there are many similarities with a cult, and I think the paranoia in particular, which the regime tries to encourage among the people, is something that leaders of cults also do. And I think the comparison with the Jim Jones cult is valid in that sense. As for the best way to deal with the North Koreans, I'm not really sure what that is at this stage. We've seen from the South Koreans' failure to generate any kind of goodwill with the North Koreans that a policy of unilateral aid or appeasement is certainly not the answer. But I think we've also seen that threatening the North Koreans applying sanctions to the North Korean economy is also not going to work.
We'll talk more about that as we go along, Devin. We're glad you called. I wanted to ask about what is it that really defines our relationship with North Korea? I mean, the Korean War was a devastating experience, but you've said it goes even deeper than that. You said what really defines the relationship in some ways wasn't the devastation of the Korean War as much as it was the victories that the Koreans feel they took from the West during the 1960s. This seems to help explain things. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, well, of course, America did completely destroy North Korea during the Korean War. It just razed the country. Almost every building of two stories and higher was destroyed by American carpet bombing. But from the North Korean perspective, that war ended in a victory, and they were able to drive the Americans out of North Korean territory. They even took the very large city of Kaesong, which they did not have before the Korean War started. So from the North Korean perspective, the country has never actually been defeated by the United States. And as you said, from the late 1960s on, there has been an unbroken string either of outright victories or of provocations that went unpunished. So the shining moment in the history of North Korean-American relations, according to Pyongyang's perspective, is the capture of the USS Pueblo in 1968. So they held the American crew of that ship for several months, and in the end, the Americans had to send a groveling letter of apology. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the North Koreans shot down the EC-121 spy plane. They killed Americans in 1976 in Panmunjom, and so on. And all of these provocations went unpunished. So the North Koreans look back on the history of their relationship with the United States with a good deal of anger, but the important thing to remember is that they do not feel very much fear. I was just talking to a North Korean refugee this morning. She came to my class to talk to my students, and she said that the top slogan of anti-Americanism is 10,000 times revenge. They feel an anger at the things that America has done to North Korea in the past, but they do not feel a fear. They have no fear or no doubt that North Korea would be able to beat the United States in a military conflict.
Let's go back to the phone. Sue is with us. Sue is in Salt Lake City. Sue, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to get your opinion on something that I was thinking of. The last president of the Republic of Korea in the South had had a policy of giving money and aid to North Korea. The current president in the Republic does not do that. He has changed directions. And I am thinking maybe what is going on here is that Kim Jong-il is needing financial help. We have caved in the past in the United States and given him help. And I'm just wondering if it's kind of like the Soviet Union thing where just before they fell, they were rattling their sabers the loudest.
B.R. Myers?
It could very well be that, Sue, but we have to keep in mind that the missile test cost something like $200 million, and the underground explosion was also a very expensive exercise. We don't really know just how dire the North Korean financial straits are at the moment, because we don't know just how much North Korea is getting from its illegal operations, from its drug running, from its counterfeiting. We don't know how much money and how much economic aid the North Koreans are getting from the Chinese. And we also don't know how much they've saved up from what they've gotten from the left-wing South Korean administrations that were in power from 1998 to 2008. I personally don't believe that that economic pressure is what is motivating North Korea. I think it's more of a crisis of legitimation. The North Korean regime is very conscious of the fact that the North Korean public is becoming more and more aware not only of the South's economic superiority, but also of the fact, and this is much more dangerous, of the fact that the South Korean people are completely happy living in South Korea and have no desire to live under Kim Jong-il. In other words, North Korean people are becoming aware that what they have been learning for most of their lives is simply untrue. And I think what we are seeing in all this saber rattling is an effort on the part of the regime in Pyongyang to inspire pride in the people. Hmm. And the only way it can do that now is through perceived successes on the military or nuclear front.
So it's like there has to be this constant turning of this cycle to keep the people believing in their sense of sacrifice. There has to be, they have to ratchet it up from time to time to keep that that sort of natural tension within the country?
Exactly, because when you no longer have an economic vision for the country, and when the economy can no longer inspire the people, because no matter how much more money the North Koreans make, they will always be lagging far behind South Korea. So the only way in which the regime can justify the existence of this separate state on the peninsula is by inspiring people with pride in the nuclear military superiority of North Korea over South Korea. So as you say, every few months, I think they do need some kind of display of North Korean strength. And at the same time, though, I believe the regime has no intention of waging war with the United States. And this is where the negotiations come in. I think North Korea negotiates with the United States in order to keep this tension from tipping into all-out war.
Sue, we're glad you called. Let's go back to the phones. Jeremy is with us in Payson, Utah. Jeremy, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
My question actually is kind of in reference to the first caller who said he kind of thought of North Korea as being similar to the Branch Davidians in kind of like a cult-like state, I guess. But I'm kind of questioning that. I mean, you see in a lot of media, North Korean media resources, when they're referring to Kim Jong-il or other political figures, they do it in a very bravado, you know, type style, you know, with a lot of glorifying names and descriptive, you know, kinds of words. But how much of that is actually, you know, just self-perpetuated by, you know, the government, and how much of it is actually a reflection of North Korean citizens' regard for their political figures.
Let me add, B.R. Myers, you've written about the fact that there's a misperception that the North Koreans have this built-in readiness to follow. Talk about that.
Yeah, I don't believe that. I mean, some people have suggested in the past that the Korean people are somehow more inclined than people in other countries to want to follow a strong leader. I don't believe that that's true. But I will say that the regime in Pyongyang does seem to enjoy a much higher level of mass support than the regimes in the old East Bloc did. And I think the reason for that has to do with the nature of the ideology itself. Communism promised people a better life. And when communism was unable to deliver on a better life, the game was over. Whereas nationalism is just as well suited to bad times as to good ones. So when times are good, it's because the race is superior. And when times are bad, it's because the evil Yankees are preventing the race from fulfilling its destiny. And I believe that this ideology is successful because we are seeing very few real refugees from North Korea. What we are seeing is a lot of economic migrants who are from the poorest, least educated, and also least propagandized sectors of society. We are seeing very few people from the middle classes or from the upper classes. We're seeing very few intelligentsia from Pyongyang, for example. And that, to me, is a reflection of the high level of support the regime still does have. I'm sure it's not the sort of fervent 100% support that you get inside a cult, but still it's something much more than we saw in the Soviet Union or in East Germany before those countries collapsed.
You talk about, you've written about, in fact, that the border with China is fairly porous, but there's no more than, I think, what did you say, 3 or 4% of the population has chosen to actually leave the country for good.
Right, yeah. You know, it's important, as much as I have a lot of sympathy, of course, for the people who leave the country, and I have a lot of sympathy for the NGOs that are working with North Korean migrants in China. But it's important not to take all of that hyperbole at face value. It is simply not true that everybody who is repatriated to the country is shot. And I have met refugees myself or migrants myself who have gone in and out of North Korea dozens of times. So this is clearly not the same kind of border that separated, say, East Germany from West Germany during the Cold War. It's much easier to cross. And yet we do not see the sort of mass exodus from North Korea that you would expect from an economically ruined state. And that points to the success of the propaganda apparatus in giving people a reason to stay where they are.
B.R. Myers, he's a contributing editor to The Atlantic, and he joined us in 2009 from his home in South Korea. His book on North Korean ideology and propaganda came out just last week in paperback. It's called The Cleanest Race. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the political culture of North Korea. The scholar and commentator B.R. Myers joined us in the summer of 2009 after North Korea had just conducted its second ever nuclear test. The country sat poised with missiles on both coasts, ready to do more tests. His book on North Korean ideology and propaganda is just out in paperback. It's called The Cleanest Race.
We have in the other room students from Roland Hall School, the Salt Lake On the Air special seminar. Their teacher is Bill Baxter, and they've come up with a few questions for you, B.R. Myers. Let me ask one. Their question, do you think the United States will eventually respond to North Korea's nuclear threat? And if so, just how?
That's a good question. So far, the United States has always backed down. We've come close to war with North Korea over the nuclear issue in 1994, And then Jimmy Carter at the last minute flew to Pyongyang at President Clinton's bequest and ended up persuading Kim Il-sung to agree to arms negotiations. And then after the nuclear test of October 2006, again, America at first responded by threatening punitive action against North Korea, but ended up going back to the negotiating table. And my feeling is that the United States is too bogged down in Iraq and Afghanistan to want to risk another war in Asia. And I think that if the North Koreans signal a readiness to engage in bilateral talks, then the Americans will agree to that.
So this question of should the United States in some way, I think you've written once, better to allow another hollow victory than humiliate North Korea before the world, is it look the other way? Is that sort of a strategy, or can that be damaging as well?
I think that can be, it can of course be damaging to look the other way all the time. But my point is that we need to keep in mind the position that the North Korean regime finds itself in. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I find a bit lamentable about the current South Korean policy towards North Korea that your caller Sue mentioned a couple of minutes ago is that the South Koreans do not leave the North Koreans any face. They do not allow North Korea to work with South Korea in a way that preserves North Korea's dignity. And this is something I think that the South Koreans need to correct. And they can look at how West Germany dealt with East Germany. Mm. West Germany did not simply, you know, shovel aid into East Germany. It attached conditions to those to that aid, but it did so in a very discreet way. For example, the West Germans used aid money to buy political prisoners out of East Germany, but this was done in a very hush-hush way. Mm. It wasn't announced in a big way over the media. And this is why I think Lee Myung-bak, the current president of South Korea, is probably not going to have much success with the North Koreans because he makes his conditions in public in front of the media. And I think the United States as well might be able to get further with the North Koreans if it was a little bit more discreet about the conditions that it was attaching to, say, American aid.
Mm. So another question from our students from Roland Hall, whether or not an invasion of North Korea is possible or even a practical idea for the United States. Is the United States even a stabilizing force in the peninsula?
Well, that's a very good question. I always tell my American listeners when I talk to American audiences that what we are doing in South Korea is we are not so much protecting capitalists from communists as protecting moderate nationalists from extreme nationalists. And that really is almost a no-win situation, and it's an inherently unstable one. We have very little way of knowing just how the South Korean people would react if North Korea were, say, to launch a missile strike on an American base. As for invading the country, you know, to go back to the North Korean migrant that I talked with this morning, she was telling my class about how there are underground bunkers built into so many of the mountains. I mean, the terrain itself would make an invasion much more difficult than, say, the invasion of Iraq or Kuwait. More importantly, though, North Korea has made very clear in the past that any American attack on North Korean soil would result in the destruction of Seoul. And the North Koreans don't even need nuclear weapons in order to flatten Seoul. They can do it very easily with the conventional missiles, with the Scuds and so on that they've had for decades. So in a sense, our ally, South Korea, is what prevents us from attacking North Korea because the North Koreans are able, so to speak, to hold South Korea hostage. So it's really the irony that we would probably be in a better position to retaliate militarily against North Korea if we did not have troops in South Korea and if South Korea were not America's ally.
Let's go back to the phones. Lars is with us, calling from Seattle, Washington. Lars, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
No, that's fine, Dave. Perhaps my question will bring some comic relief. I hear that Kim Jong-il is very good at playing golf. And I'm wondering, he apparently scored several holes in one on his very first round of golf, and this leaked out through the propaganda machine that has been mentioned several times. Now, we in the West just see that as completely ridiculous, and I'm just wondering how that propaganda machine can expect us in the West or those in South Korea to take that seriously at all. And then how would we take anything else that they would say about Kim Jong-il or the country in general, its economics or its political stature seriously after we hear something like that?
That's a good question, Lars. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, though, we need to keep in mind that the propaganda is not there for external use. The North Koreans really have two kinds of propaganda. They have a very rabidly ethno-nationalist kind of propaganda and a very extravagant adulation of the leader that they disseminate into the masses at home, and they usually have a more sophisticated propaganda that they present to the outside world. For example, the KCNA, or the Korean Central News Agency reports that you can read online in English or Spanish, are much more toned down than the sort of things that the North Koreans themselves get. Now, I see these reports of things like holes in one and of these alleged miracles that Kim Jong-il has performed, but I don't see them in the North Korean domestic media, and I don't see them in the Korean Central News Agency either. And I always wonder where people get a hold of them. Huh. They don't really loom as large in the North Korean personality cult as we might think. They do seem to be aware that the rest of the world finds them ridiculous, but I think that only spurs them on to behave more aggressively. They expect us to take them seriously on the basis of what they do on the military and nuclear front, and I think they don't really mind whether we laugh at him that much on the basis of what is said about his holes in one and so on.
Right. Lars, thanks very much. Glad you called. Back to the phones. Craig is with us in American Fork, Utah. Craig, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Sure. Professor Myers, I appreciate this conversation. It makes sense of North Korea that I've never understood before. I've always credited détente for having something to do with bringing down the Soviet Union by making the people in the East aware of their economic situation relative to the West. And you said that the North Korean people are becoming aware. How are they becoming aware? I understood that everything is controlled, the media, to the point that they have no ability to become aware. And how can we enhance their understanding of the world?
Well, there's actually two things. For one thing, the information cordon that once sealed the country off from the outside world has been crumbling really ever since the mid-1990s. A lot of migrants are going into China and coming back with smuggled TV sets, with smuggled radios, and they're listening to the BBC World Service, for example, or they're watching Chinese TV, or they're watching South Korean videos. And in that way, they began to learn, even in the late 1990s, that South Korea was far ahead of North Korea in economic terms. And then the North Korean propaganda apparatus was clever enough to concede this fact to the North Korean people under the terms that I said before. They said the South Koreans are richer than we are, but we have more pride. So the success of the South Korean economy does not pose quite the same threat to the North Korean regime that the success of the East Germany, success of the West German economy did to East Germany back during the Cold War. Remember, this is not a Marxist-Leninist state. It's a nationalist state. So economic success and failure is not really such a big deal. And just like Germany in the last years of the Second World War, they are able to extract a sort of heroism from their hardship. Another thing that we need to remember is that they are not so vulnerable to the influx of culture from outside. People have spotted Mickey Mouse knapsacks and jeans and T-shirts and in Pyongyang, and they've heard rock and roll music in North Korea. And they tend to jump to the conclusion that all this is really undermining the regime. But actually it isn't, because nationalism is something much stronger than that. South Korea is, for example, open to the outside world, and yet South Korea is also one of the most nationalist countries around. And we need to remember that the Luftwaffe pilots in the Second World War, some of them flew into battle with Mickey Mouse painted on their fuselages. You know, the Nazis loved Walt Disney. So we need to keep in mind that this is not the East Bloc. And things are going to move, I think, very differently from the way they did in the last years of the Cold War.
Craig, thanks. There have been conflicting reports about the health of Kim Jong-il. What do we know about the extent of his health problems?
That's a really good question. I mean, you've seen the photographs. I'm sure your listeners have seen the photographs as well. And it's clear from them that his health has gone downhill very quickly. He's very gaunt now. He's not using one of his hands. And, of course, this has lent power to all the speculation about the succession issue. And, of course, today the South Korean news is full of the report that Kim Jong-il has chosen a successor,
right,
namely one of his sons, Kim Jong-un, who is in his mid-20s. We really don't know very much about his health at all, but the general view seems to be that he's going downhill much further than anybody expected.
You've said that we shouldn't assume a hereditary succession, that's not necessarily inevitable. Do you still believe that?
I still believe that it's not necessarily inevitable, because the last hereditary succession, the succession from Kim Il-sung to Kim Jong-il, did not go very smoothly either. And for the past 14, 15 years, the North Korean regime has found it necessary to tell the North Korean people that Kim Jong-il was the man that Kim Il-sung wanted for the job. And the fact that they have to do this even now, after 15 years of Kim Jong-il's rule, indicates to me that the North Korean people have never fully accepted that hereditary succession, even though it was prepared 20 years in advance. And that makes me wonder if the North Korean regime can really pull off another hereditary succession with a son that the North Korean people have hitherto heard nothing about.
You hear a lot of talk about whether or not one leader will emerge, or whether there'll be, like in a lot of socialist regimes, a kind of a collective leadership. How important is the idea of there being one, single mother figure, parent? How important is that?
I think it's hugely important, because you have a country, as I said, that has a ruined economy. In other words, the regime is never going to be able to derive much support from economic success. This is a people that needs to be inspired. They need to be led. It's not enough simply to manage them. And I cannot imagine a group of faceless bureaucrats or a group of army generals in their 70s and 80s inspiring that kind of devotion and that kind of support in the masses that Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung have inspired so far. So I would expect that there might be a transition regime paving the way for an individual successor, but at some stage we're going to end up with a single leader, just like North Korea has had since 1945.
So what happens when Kim Jong-il dies? You've said there may be periods of hysteria almost in the country, not as much grief as I think you said anxiety.
Yeah, it's normal for people to feel very strong anxiety and fear for their future when a dictator dies who's been in power for a long time. We had the same thing happen here in South Korea when Park Chung-hee was assassinated in 1979. Many people cried for days. Even if they did not particularly like Park Chung-hee, they were worried about what would happen to the country. And I think this is what I'm afraid of, is that when Kim Jong-il dies, you are going to see what anthropologists refer to as a flight from grief syndrome. We see this in African tribes, for example, or in underdeveloped parts of the world, that when a leader dies, the cry goes up to wage war on a neighboring village or on a neighboring state. And we've seen this in more developed societies like Egypt, for example. When Nasser died, everybody waged war on Israel. So this is the kind of thing we need to worry about. And it's especially likely in North Korea, I think, because whoever takes over from Kim Jong-il is going to have to prove his mettle through a military victory of some kind. Kim Jong-il himself was only able to legitimize himself in the mid-1990s by presenting himself as a person who had brought the Americans whimpering and shaking to the negotiation table in 1994. So I think whoever he chooses to succeed him is going to have to go through the same sort of hero-making story.
So we should expect a ratcheting up of the conflict with Washington and the rest
of the world? Right, and that may well be what's going on at this point in time, because the same sort of ratcheting up of tension took place in 1993 when Kim Il-sung was alive. What Kim Il-sung did was basically stand back, allow Kim Jong-il to begin taking over the reins of power, and then point to Kim Jong-il's success in dealing with the Yankees as proof of his suitability for the job. That may well be what's happening now.
Scholar and researcher B.R. Myers. He joined us in the summer of 2009. He teaches in the International Studies Department at Dongseo University in Busan, South Korea. He's also a contributing editor to The Atlantic. His book, The Cleanest Race, just came out in paperback. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.